They supply watchful Putiners to ensure the spiritual distractions of people right from their birth. So because, turning over to page 13, because atheism is so prevalent, it's such like a general principle among the people, it's very hard to avoid this. It's very hard to avoid these Putiners having such a powerful position. Point 4 begins with a very powerful statement. The church, or religious institution, we could say, that has the best chance of survival in this damned world is that of atheism under the convenient guise of theism. Isn't it true? If you want to be popular, I mean, you've got to be, they would think, you've got to be popular. Otherwise, how do you get an income? If you don't get any income, how can you continue doing anything, particularly pushing on some large institution? So you've got to be popular. And if you want to be popular, then you have to speak in such a way which is pleasing to the people. And if the people are generally not very God-conscious, they don't really want to be too serious about religion and be too austere or like that, then you must teach something in the guise of theism, but something which will appeal to them. Like, you can do anything. Doesn't matter. Just believe in such and such. And then you'll be a first-class religionist. Isn't it amazing? Do anything. But just accept this or do that or give a donation. And you'll be a first-class, pucker, spiritual person. The churches or religious institutions have always proved the staunchest upholders of the grossest forms of worldliness, from which even the worst of non-ecclesiastical criminals are found to recoil. Now, just one example of that. Well, there are a number of examples, but one I thought was a very good example. Take the subject of meat eating. Now, the people in general, they normally eat meat. But they normally eat meat because they like it. If you ask for some sort of philosophical argument why you should eat meat, they won't bother. They'll just say, oh, I like it. But these contaminated, perverted religious institutions, they have a whole philosophy that you should eat meat. If you don't eat meat, that's very bad. Ramanujacharya Prabhu was saying that while he was in America a few years ago, he saw one of these tracts, these little publications that Christian organizations put out, and the title was, Satan Does Not Like the Taste of Blood. In other words, if you don't like eating meat, you'd rather be a vegetarian. It's satanic. Jesus ate meat, so you should eat meat. If you don't, then you're not following Jesus. Well, like it happened in Cape Town last year, a very extraordinary thing. We have a very successful society on the campus of UCT, the University of Cape Town. We're making a very big impact there. So the Jewish society, student society, they're a little concerned. So one of their big rabbis in Cape Town wrote an article for them, for their campus magazine. And in it he said that this vegetarianism is dangerous. Watch out. Because it's natural for us in our human condition to eat meat. So we all know if you try and suppress something which is natural, hold it down and hold it down by force, then later on it bursts out in an even worse way. So saying you should watch out because if you try to suppress your natural tendency to eat meat, later on it can burst out in the form of cannibalism.
Yeah.
So in the name of religion, as a religious principle, he's advocating that you should do it. So, this is worse than just the materialists who just eat meat just because they like it. Trying to make it into a religious principle. Or another example, you've all heard of Soho in London. Most of Soho is owned by the Anglican Church. They're getting their income from renting the buildings out there. And of course, most of those buildings are brothels and, you know, just, it's the red light area. We don't have an area here in South Africa as bad as that. It's simply pure degradation. But they'll overlook it. They'll overlook it because they're getting their money. They're getting their income. So these things are going on. So then he says, next paragraph, he's not just trying to be critical, and he accepts that the original purpose of the established institutions may not always be objectionable when the original founder, like Christ or whoever it may be of any particular tradition, was on the planet. Generally, we would accept that they're trying to do a good thing. That was their idea. But no stable religious arrangement for instructing the masses has yet been successful. Because, you know, the real principles of religion are a little strict. And if you want to be popular, then you can't tell people that you have to be strict, because the majority of people won't be able to do it. So if you want to be popular, you have to water it down, so that then they can maintain their more or less fallen condition, but feel that, oh, I'm very religious, and I'm a member of such a nice institution, so let me support it. Then he makes a point, this is a little more subtle. Lord Chaitanya enjoins all absence of conventionalism for the teachers of eternal religion or real religion. So what he means there is that Lord Chaitanya is teaching that you can't just have a religion based on arbitrary rules and regulations, just arbitrary conventions. That in our religion, we have decided not to eat meat on Friday like that. It's just an arbitrary idea. It might as well be Thursday or Saturday, but we just decided to make it Friday. It's not an actual religious principle like you must chant the names of God. It's not like that. It's just a convention, an arbitrary rule. So Lord Chaitanya didn't appreciate arbitrary rules. He, of course, it's not that Lord Chaitanya said there shouldn't be any rules. There should be rules. But there should be rules which are very intelligently conceived, so that one's natural Krishna consciousness is encouraged to manifest and develop. Like we mentioned earlier, getting up early in the morning. Now you could say that getting up early in the morning rather than getting up late is as arbitrary as not eating meat on Friday rather than Saturday. But it's not the case. If you get up late, then you'll be in the mode of ignorance. And you may try to chant and do all your spiritual activities, but it'll be very difficult. But if you get up early, then easily you can absorb your mind, at least more easily, in hearing and chanting, because the atmosphere is much more conducive early. So it's not just an arbitrary rule that 4 in the morning rather than 7 or 8, you know, Friday rather than Thursday. It's not arbitrary. But these are rules and regulations which actually help one's spiritual development. And then he says, it doesn't follow that mechanically adopting spontaneous devotional service will just automatically make a person a fit teacher of religion. You know, the idea is that through following all these rules and regulations very carefully and chanting and being very nicely engaged, one will become purified, as we mentioned earlier, and get a taste for Krishna consciousness. So when the alarm goes off at 4 a.m, you won't think that, oh my God, you know, oh no, don't tell me I have to get up again. You won't think like that, but you'll think, oh wonderful, now my body's had enough rest, I can get up again and get on with my real business of Krishna consciousness. So one becomes more and more spontaneous, not in a whimsical way, but in a genuine Krishna conscious way. One becomes inspired to practice Krishna consciousness very enthusiastically. So if a person who's not on that level tries to make out that they are, then they become like sore thumbs. They just mess things up. Rupa Goswami says, Shruti Smriti Purana Adi Pancharatra Vidimvana Akantakir Hariya Bhaktir Utpata Yaiva Kalpate, that a person who tries to practice devotional service independent of the Shastric injunctions, Shruti, Smriti, Pancharatra, independent of the real scriptural teachings, simply becomes a disturbance. Regulation is necessary to control the inherent worldliness of conditioned souls. Now, point 5. No mechanical regulation, none of these arbitrary principles, has any value for controlling the inherent worldliness of the conditioned souls. It won't work. That's why, I know when I was young I had some Catholic friends, they were very close friends of our family, and they would very religiously not eat meat on Fridays, they'd eat fish. They were, you know, very serious Catholics by the terms of the day. But now, that's no longer a rule. It's no longer a rule. Why? Because it's an arbitrary rule. And it didn't help people to get free of the desire to eat meat. The desire was there, and after a certain period of time, the people who really felt they wanted to eat meat on Fridays, they made a big lobby, and so the Roman Catholic Church was forced to change the rule. And now it's no longer a rule. So these mechanical rules won't help. Just won't help. For a rule to help, it has to be a rule which actually encourages spiritual development, and then a natural spiritual enthusiasm will arise and the person will be able to follow the rule without it being a struggle. So a bona fide teacher of religion is neither a product of nor a favorer of these mechanical rules and regulations. And in his hands, he won't let Krishna consciousness degenerate into these typical lifeless so-called religious arrangements. The mere pursuit of fixed doctrines and fixed liturgies cannot hold a person to the real spirit of the teachings. If you want to hold a person to the real spirit, you have to teach them in such a way that they start to realize the spirit and experience like spirituality, then they'll naturally become inspired. So anyway, goes on, the great ecclesiastical establishments, the very popular religions, are the dikes and dams trying to hold back the water which cannot be held by these contrivances. In other words, you may have your half-baked religion. People can do anything they like. and you give them a certificate that this is a first-class religionist. But it won't work. You may think, oh, now I've got my popular support, now we're going to go on. But it won't work. The whole thing will fall to pieces, actually, degenerate further and further. Actually, these ecclesiastical establishments, it ends up that the masses take control. The congregation takes over the religion. You know, when we talk of the Christians, seeing he's sort of talking in Christian terms here, who are the most sincere and serious Christians? They're people like the monks, people like that, who've actually dedicated their lives to following the teachers, living very austere, devotional lives. But where do they figure in the greater Christian picture? Nowhere. It's all these popular teachers. Actually, those popular teachers, they belong in the congregation. They should be the audience. Would it do them a lot of good? I don't take yourselves to be congregation, your devotees, but by congregation I mean the lay people who are really, they're the ones who really need help. So they belong in the congregation, they belong in the audience, but through political means and democratic means like that, Prabhupada referred to democracy as demon crazy. So through democratic means, the congregation ended up taking over the religious institution. Same in Hinduism. Those who should be hearing are speaking. And those who are hearing the wrong thing. Sad. So then he makes an interesting point in the last sentence of this paragraph. The people of this world understand religion in terms of religion meaning preventive systems. That, you know, sometimes people come and ask us, in your religion, are you allowed to do such and such? Because they think that religion means a system in which you're not allowed to do things. And supposedly by not doing those things, you'll advance. So that's what they think religion is. They don't have any idea of spiritual life based on a genuine spiritual enthusiasm or a spontaneous attraction to serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That you might actually practice religious life because you like it, because you get much more pleasure from it than other things. Therefore, you can put those other things aside. Neither can any earthly contrivance for the permanent preservation of life eternal on the mundane, or neither can there be any earthly contrivance which will succeed in creating, you know, like a better situation on this earth in material terms. Point six. We're still on page 13, point 6, you see. I hope I haven't lost you. So people are greatly mistaken if they think their worldly conditions. We're on page 13, point 6. People are mistaken if they think their worldly situations are going to be improved. In other words, they're going to get more sense gratification. You know, if you chant Hare Krishna, you'll get more money, a better job. Your health will improve. So don't expect things like that. And anything can happen by Krishna's grace. Whatever he wants to happen will happen. But don't think that if you practice real religion, that this is going to be like your key to increased sense gratification and material advancement. Actually, it's there for spiritual advancement. So these worldly expectants, the ones who are very keen on gratifying their senses via religion, they become patrons of the Putanas. Of course, birds of a feather flock together. And they want to stifle Krishna consciousness. That's why Krishna consciousness, unfortunately, comes under attack from time to time. From all sorts of quarters, it's quite amazing. Anyway, even though they try to do that, it can't really work. Because the nature of Krishna consciousness is like that. Once it's there, then it, because it's genuinely spiritual, it tends to just keep manifesting. The Putanas, they only really can affect the atheists or those who have no spiritual strength. As soon as, now we're in point 7, bottom of page 13. As soon as Krishna consciousness really is manifest, then the Putanas are silenced. In other words, as soon as the Krishna consciousness movement makes greater and greater inroads in society, then these bogus teachers, they start fading out and losing their power. Because people come to see that, oh, here's the genuine thing. The Prabhupada, you know these two prayers we recite to Srila Prabhupada, the second one, Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharane, Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschitade Jitarane, that was written by Prabhupada himself. And there he was expressing what he felt were like his main mission or his main, what he wanted to be successful in, to defeat impersonalism and voidism. Some of you may have heard this story before, that in the very early days, right in the very early days, Prabhupada was preaching to the devotees. They were extreme neophytes. And almost every class, he'd get stuck into the Mayavadis. And the devotees, they'd never heard of a Mayavadi. They didn't know what a Mayavadi was. So they're wondering, why does Swamiji talk about these Mayavadis? Who are they? Why doesn't he talk about, they thought that he was overlooking. You know, if he wanted to talk about people who are anti-religious or had bogus philosophies, they thought that there were other people who he should have been talking about. And they thought that maybe Swamiji, he's an old man, maybe he had some bad encounter with one of these Mayavadi people. And now he has a pet hate. So sometimes when he gets worked up, he just gets into the Mayavadis. But actually the fact is that they're practically the heaviest of the Putanas. Then a very interesting point is made, starting the last few words of page 13 and going over onto the top of page 14, that the would-be slayer is herself slain. When Krishna consciousness becomes established, then Putana, or the Putanas, who want to kill Krishna consciousness, they get, so to speak, killed. And this being killed by Krishna is the reward for certain services that they render. They actually, the Putanas do something useful. What is that? They do something which is a real service to the cause of real theism. What is that? They strangle all hypocritical demonstrations against their own hypocrisy. I don't know if you can digest that. That they're the big hypocrites and they're controlling the situation in spiritual circles with their hypocrisy. And then they have their opposition, their competitors, other pseudo-spiritualists who are not as powerful as them, who are also hypocrites. So the little hypocrites protest about the hypocrisy of the big hypocrites, and the big hypocrites crush them. Isn't it? These things are going on. So, unwittingly, they render that service to the cause of theism. Of course, Putana, point 8, doesn't like to receive that reward. And Kamsa doesn't like losing the services of his most trusted, very important agent. The effective silencing of the whole race of Putanas is the first clear indication of the appearance of the Absolute on the mundane plane. Putana was the first demon killed by Krishna. And as Krishna consciousness becomes established, one of the first main signs that it is successfully being established is that the Putanas start being threatened and being put out of business by Krishna consciousness. Now what we'd like you to do is try to memorize a few of these points. Why don't you try to memorize, say, 4 points out of these 8 for our test on Wednesday? Any 4. Doesn't have to be word for word, but just the basic idea. Yeah, any 4 of these points as summarized on page 14. Yeah, basically. In your own terms. Is that clear? Any 4 from page 14. Where we've listed them out, a brief summary. Anyone not clear on what I mean? Any questions or comments?
Page 12, 23.
Yeah.
The sentence that the state shocked that arrangement of all established churches of the world.
Yeah.
He said we could also be placed at a religious institution.
Yeah.
If you take educational institutions, then they also maintain the status quo.
Yeah.
So they are also producing goodness.
Why don't you read? We haven't got time, otherwise we'd do it. You read the article also written by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, or edited by him, about, who is it? Vatsasura. It's all about education. And it's in the same mood. It's, where is it? Vatsasura. Vatsasura starts on page 21. The article starts on page 21 and goes on for quite a few pages to page 25. Just for your own interest, you can read that. Starting from page 21 through to page 25. It's all about the perverted educational systems of this material world. Yeah, there's not a conspiracy as such, but in effect it's like that. They're all working together.
Because, like, if you take universities, for example, when you get radical students, they are supposedly criticizing the establishment.
Yeah.
But when they come out of that education system, then they become part of the establishment.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
So those that are unconformists become conformists.
Yes. Maya is so powerful that you may be a big, non-conformist, social sort of reformer or whatever, but then Maya reforms you according to her plan. When I was back in New Zealand, there was one young man. He was just like that. Very intelligent and very outspoken. Those were the hippie days. So he was the leader. And, you know, he would start riots and things like that about Vietnam and about so many things, about, you know, whatever he could. Tim Shadbolt. Then I went back to New Zealand in 1990, and, well, that city Auckland is made up. It's a conglomerate of a number of cities. I found out he was the mayor of one of the cities, and he was driving around in a Jaguar. And Jerry Rubin, who perhaps some of you have heard of, he was the leader of the Yippies. They were the violent revolutionary sort of wing of the hippies of the 60s. They used to work with the Black Panthers and other, like, real revolutionary groups. bombing things. But I saw an article in Time magazine, actually it was about 10 years ago, that he's now a stockbroker on Wall Street. So what can you say? All glory is to Maya. There's one of the acharyas, I think it's Sanatan, one of our acharyas was saying, talking about the power of the material energy. And he says, when I see what you do to people, then I feel that I can only offer my obeisances to you.